All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change. Earth Seed, the Books of the Living. Hello, I'm Kennedy Weisel.
And I'm Rebecca Capone.
And this is Reading Pop Classics. Today we're discussing Octavia Butler's 1993 speculative fiction novel about a future of gross economic disparity, wanton violence, and crumbling U.S. infrastructure, The Parable of the Sower. The book would go on to be nominated for the Nebula Award for Best Novel in 1995. It would lose to Greg Bear's Moving Mars. It made the New York Times bestseller list in 2020 off a paperback reprinting that sold well as a depressed and pessimistic nation gave the already well-lauded book a second wave of popularity. Its sequel, Parable of the Talents, would win the Nebula Award for Best Novel in 1999, beating George R.R. Martin's A Clash of Kings that year. And the series ends with that novel. Butler was plagued by writer's block as she attempted the third book in the series, Parable of the Trickster. Octavia E. Butler was the first science fiction author to receive a MacArthur Genius Grant, and she was a multiple recipient of both the Hugo and Nebula Awards. She was given a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Penn American Center and inducted into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. And there's both an asteroid named for her and a mountain on one of the moons of Pluto. The moon is Charon, and the mountain name for her is Butler Mons. Additionally, the landing site of the Mars 2020 Perseverance rover within the Jezero crater on the planet Mars was named for her. The Octavia E. Butler Landing is what it's called. The Mars landing took place nearly 15 years to the day after her death. She died at only 58 in 2006, and unable to finish Parable of the Trickster, the series was left unfinished. So, Rebecca, how did we do on the Bechdel test?
This book passes the Bechdel test. Lauren has conversations with so many people throughout the book, and they're very rarely centered on a male, unless it is like a brother or a father, or her father figure. Book passes the Bechdel test really easily, but it's something that we've discussed throughout the books, like just a pattern that I'm noticing as we do this particular segment. The more conversations a book has, like the more dialogue there is, I have found it's got a better chance of passing the Bechdel test.
Yeah. This one passes pretty handily, just like Eleanor Oliphant did.
Yeah, so, this was an easy. I didn't have to go back and look for conversations. They're in there, and this one was pretty straightforward.
Before we get into the plot too much, would you call this dystopian?
Oh, 100%.
Is it? I'm asking sort of as like technical terms. Like, does this count as a dystopian novel or dystopian novel? Do dystopian novels need to have a setting that is other than the near future? This comes out in 1993. It is set, by the way, this year. So this July will be Parable of the Sower year. The book starts in July 2024. This is the Parable of the Sower.
This is where we begin. This is where Earthseed begins. This is where we join Lauren Olamina.
Yeah, this will be hot Parable of the Sower summer.
I don't see any reason that this is not a dystopian novel. I mean, the book came out, you know, as we discussed, in the early 90s. So this would have been set 30 years in the future. And it does, I want to say it describes a culture and a society very different than our own, but we'll discuss that a little more in depth as we get into this book, certainly. But however, it is set in, you know, in a not too distant future, but it's set in the future. And it is certainly a dystopian society. So I feel like this passes into, because, you know, sometimes we get these dystopian novels and they don't necessarily have they don't have years set forth, right? Like sometimes it's a little vaguer when they're discussing the past. So it could be 30 years in the future. It could be 200 years in the future. You know, we don't always know. Some novels do set the parameters and try to give us more of a date in a way, I think, to think about it. I actually think one of the strengths of this book is that it was not set 100 years in the future. It's not. So Octavia Butler very clearly very clearly is a science fiction writer. That is really the majority of her work, and that is how she's known. But these books are not science fiction. These books feel really, these books feel palpable. These books feel, these books feel like a place our society could be in fairly shortly, I think.
Speculative fiction is a term that I heard ascribed to this book. I think I mentioned it in the intro. I think speculative fiction sometimes describes science fiction that is a little closer to the bone. I also read in some of my research this referred to as, I think, quiet sci-fi was the term that I heard, that or the term that I read, that pointed to its, unlike some of Octavia Butler's other science fiction works, there isn't aliens in this, there isn't telekinesis in it. While they talk about going to another planet, no one actually leaves Earth. There's not spaceships, rocket ships. It lacks some of the sci-fi things that we think of as, you know, the Star Trek, the Star Wars, some of the stuff. It takes place on Earth, with the exception of her hyper-empathy condition. There isn't much that separates it from the world as we know it today, besides, you know, a deteriorating society that is on the brink of collapse.
Yeah, something that, again, that I think is a strength in this book is that, right, is that there's not, there isn't this, like, technology that seems very, very far-fetched, right? Or, you know, I want to use an example of, I know that there are other dystopian novels, but we do talk about pop classics on this podcast, and The Hunger Games is one of them, okay? So I could give better examples, but this is just the one that popped into my head.
That's a good example. Go ahead.
But in Hunger Games, right? So that's one where I don't think we don't have a year setting. We don't have years that we can look at it and compare to our time for the Hunger Games that I remember. It's not like, oh, in 1998, we had this series of floods and this and that, and then pandemic came about and now we're in 30, 35, right? Like there's no year setting for the Hunger Games. We are only sort of given this is what happened in the past and this is where we are now. But so the Hunger Games, we have hovercraft, and you know, the Capitol has all of this fancy technology and all of these things that set it very far in the future, and it feels...
In Hunger Games, we are on the other side of an event. We don't necessarily know what it was or when it happened, but the event has happened and society has reformed into what we begin with and the world that we're dropped into, which I think is a hallmark of a lot of dystopian future, is this is a time in the future and now, you know, society is broken into four separate groups, and A group does this and B group does that. And when everyone turns 21, they all have to, you know, do whatever the thing is. Like that's sort of a framework and a trope of dystopian science fiction, is that we've already arrived at a restructuring of society as we know it.
That's a good point. A lot of dystopian novels are post-apocalyptic.
Yes. And the reason that I asked at the top of this is, do you consider this dystopian, is because we're pre-apocalypse in this. We are at the end of the empire, the crumbling of what we know. Everything is in the act of actively falling apart. It hasn't completely gone into whatever great event we usually think, the apocalypse or the great change.
Yes, that's a good point. But I think that something can be dystopian without, I don't think that the post-apocalyptic aspect is necessarily what makes something dystopian. I think it's where we're at a point where society has fallen apart. That to me is what a dystopian novel describes. And that's certainly what is happening here. So society has fallen apart. This is not an adequate way for anybody to live. I think even people that are, even like the rich and stuff in this book, I mean, we don't see the rich in this book. We hear about them more than we see them. We don't have any rich characters, but I don't get the impression that even if you're rich, this is a great time to be living.
No, and I'll agree with you. I was asking, and I'm with you. Okay, this is dystopian.
Yeah, but I think that's an interesting conversation, because as you've said, like as we were talking, that it was like I was thinking, like, oh yeah, right. Like a lot of dystopian novels do come in this; they're post-apocalyptic. Something has happened. A lot of times to push the world into a dystopian event. But again, what I think is the strength of this novel is that that's not what happens. this is just, I think that she's taking a look around at societal injustice, at climate change, the human contribution to climate change, and then made this speculation about what that's going to do to society.
I think it's interesting for the author to draw the reader to the fact that dystopia does not have to be fantastical. The dystopia can just be a crumbling of systems that you kind of take for granted, and that's what she does in this book. So when the book opens, we're with Lauren Olamina, and the book is structured as journal entries, diary entries that she is writing between July of 2024 and the fall of 2027. I think the book ends in September of 2027 or thereabouts anyway. Lauren is 15 at the start of this novel. She lives in a walled community, which we come to learn is just the neighborhood that she lives in. And the people within that neighborhood have built a wall around it to keep out the elements of the outside. She lives with her father, her stepmother, and her
four brothers,
two stepbrothers and one.
No, all four are half brothers. Lauren's
half,
father,
three half
Lauren's,
brothers?
Yeah, Lauren's, I think there's four. Lauren's father and mother have just Lauren. Lauren's mother is a drug addict, a drug called like Paracetco. I think she dies from a drug overdose, or she dies as a part of her drug addiction. But because she was taking drugs when she was pregnant with Lauren, she has passed on hyper empathy syndrome to Lauren, which means that Lauren shares other people's pain and pleasure for that matter.
She feels physical pain when she sees someone else be physically hurt.
Correct.
And it can incapacitate her. It's not merely the act of empathy. I just want to be clear. It is, physically experiences. She can be rendered unconscious from the pain. She can be completely incapacitated and unable to move or get up. Like, she feels it viscerally.
Correct. Which we can see where that's a weakness, but we can see particularly where that's a weakness in a society that has so much violence and pain and death that are just kind of a daily part of life outside of the wall of this community. And the first time I read this
her father is a Baptist minister. He is sort of a leader in the neighborhood community, and he works, both him and his wife, Lauren's stepmother, work at the university.
Correct. They are PhD educated. They're PhD educated members of society. Yes, they do both work for a local university. And then Lauren's father and stepmother have four sons. So she has four half brothers. Keith and Marcus are the oldest two. Those are the ones we kind of get to know the best in this book. And then the younger two, we really don't hear much about them. We just know they exist.
I found a quote. Lauren describes them: three smart sons and one dumb one, and it's the dumb one she loves best. And she's referring to her stepmother,
right? And Keith is the dumb one.
Yes. And I normally wouldn't quote something this long, but just to give a little sense of where the novel begins, I'm going to read this beginning. According to my father, the big city is a carcass covered with too many maggots. I think he's right, though not all the maggots are in LA. They're here too. But maggots tend not to be early morning types. We rode past people stretched out, sleeping on the sidewalks, and a few just waking up, but they paid no attention to us. I saw at least three people who weren't going to wake up ever again. One of them was headless. I caught myself looking around for the head. After that, I tried not to look around at all. A woman, young, naked, and filthy, stumbled along past us. I got a look at her slack expression and realized that she was dazed or drunk or something. Maybe she had been raped so much that she was crazy. I'd heard stories of that happening. Or maybe she was just high on drugs. And in that short little bit, that's maybe half of this page, Butler gives us everything we need to know about this world.
I agree. And something that struck me in the first 30, 40 pages of this novel is this sort of very almost casual and like straight to the point language and language about how horrific this is. Like this is right outside the walls of where they live. This is right outside of this, like, of this community that they live in that is struggling, that does not have a lot of money. It's a pretty self-reliant community, but you know, they don't have a lot of money. They have to protect themselves. They're growing a lot of their own food. They're mending their clothes. There's not a lot to be had. And then right outside of the walls is this level of poverty. And there's so many things. And I think that quote that you picked is such a great example. It's the way Lauren's describing it, right? This is what she's grown up with. So if I were to describe riding a bike around, you know, my neighborhood or my community, and I was just giving very straightforward observations of what was going on around me, like, that's kind of what Lauren is doing. And it is these things that are absolutely horrific.
It's the language in this, the way this is presented, reminds me of Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which
yes.
is also a lot of short, descriptive, declarative sentences. And maybe both of these authors realize this, but I think if you're setting something in such a dire setting, pulling back on your prose a little bit probably helps. Like, you probably don't need to rely on flowery prose as much or really go ham on your descriptions when you're describing these things that are pretty horrific to begin with. And I think a strength of both of those books is that short to the point gets us there.
Just the very idea of what is going on is so horrific that we don't need, and I love Stephen King, but we don't need a Stephen King, you know, level of description of the horror. That's not what the book is meant to be. It's not meant to be a horror. It's meant to make a setting and for us to understand what kind of world we're dealing with.
And if you read any other Cormac McCarthy books, from Blood Meridian to All the Pretty Horses, he'll write a three paragraph sentence in there with no syntax. Like, he'll string some stuff together. Like, he'll really hang some bells on it and throw in a bunch of words, and he'll take some twists and turns and some back alleys. It's just in The Road, he seemed to realize, like, a blasted out landscape with like terrible things happening. In this one, short, quick, to the point. It also points to who our narrator is in Parable of the Sower, because she's a 15-year-old girl at the start. She's only 18 when it ends.
Yes, she's very mature for her age, which, I mean, I think is, she's very mature for her age. And I want to say that seems like it would be a part of growing up in this type of world. But Keith is an idiot, right? So
let's talk about Keith.
And he's also grown up, you know, in this world. Oh, I'm furious with Keith. Furious for what he puts his family through. I'm furious for him. He's also out on this bike ride, and it's just like, yeah, this guy's just over here, you know, decapitated. And that's just like a thing that we see. And he's like, oh man, I got to get out of this community. I want to go into the city. I want to be out living in this. And it's like, do you? Because this seems horrible. It seems like a horrible place to live.
According to Lauren, who is our narrator, he has been like that since he was a kid. He is a selfish sociopath who thinks of nothing except his immediate gratification. And he's 12 or 13 in our opening couple of chapters, where he starts sneaking out of the community. And to be clear, we're saying community. She refers to it as a community within the book. It's a street with a cul-de-sac at the end of it. It's not hundreds of people. There's like 35 of them.
There's more than that, because so many people, there's 10 or 12 houses, I think, but so many people are living in each of those houses. Like Lauren Olamina's family, for instance, that's 7 people living in a house. And we do have descriptions that, like, you know, people lose their homes or they lose their jobs. They don't have any money. We have 10, 12, 13 people living in a lot of these houses. There's multi-families, multi-generations living in these houses. So I think, because I remember noticing on this, so this is the second time that I have read this book. And I do remember noticing in this one, like, realizing, and I don't know if I realized it in the first one, of like, oh, there's only like 10 houses in this cul-de-sac, but there is probably 90 or so people, which I mean, still is small. It's something we can circle back to this, but I think something that is interesting, something that I think is a worthy discussion in this book is the discussion of community and what community is. Because by the end of this book, and again, we can circle back to this, but by the end of this book, Lauren has created a community, and that's 10 or so people that she's picked up on the road.
The arc of this book is the burning down of one world and the seed, hence the title, or one of the meanings of the title. But yes, the burning down of one world, the ending of one world, and the beginning of another. And the world that we start off with, which is the one that her father leads, or he is a leader within it, I think, with a couple other guys in the neighborhood. Him and his wife are both leaders in the community. He is a spiritual center of the community. He is their minister, and he does their Sunday services. Mm-hmm. The scene that I read from where they're riding through the town and she sees the dead people and the headless body and the naked woman, they're on their way to do a baptism. Like they're going to be baptized.
There's a church that is basically a fortress, right? Like there are walls around it. There's a high fence around it. It's a very well protected church. And her father elects, he wants his children and some other children in the community that the families have chipped in for, like the water for the baptism font, to have clean water in the baptism font. And he wants them to be baptized in a more official or religious setting than their living room, which is where he is offering the Sunday service for the community. Keith wants to leave this protection of the, he wants to leave this protection. He's anxious to go out and prove that he's a man.
Yeah, that seems to be his thing. I mean, that's how Lauren describes it. He's anxious to go out and prove that he's a man, that he can be on his own. And then he does. So one of the first conflicts, one of the first things that happens to disrupt this world more so than just where it happens to be placed is that Keith leaves, even though they're not supposed to. And he comes back missing his shoes, all beaten up, and everyone's upset. He's way too young to be doing this, but...
way too upset. And his father beats him. His father really really physically punishes him for what he's put the family through, for the threat to the community, because when he's beaten up, his clothes are taken, his shoes are taken, and now somebody has a key to the community. So new keys have to be made for every single person. It's an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment to the family because his father is a community leader and he has put every single person who lives in that community in danger by leaving and losing the key. And he's put himself in danger.
Yeah, he's only 12 or 13. I think he's only 12. The first time he leaves, I think.
The first time he leaves, I believe you're right. I believe he's 12.
So he's punished for it. He does get new shoes, but then he does it again. And the next time he comes back, he's wearing a whole new outfit, much nicer than he can afford. And the second time when he runs away, he steals his mother's gun.
They've given him a BB gun. They gave him a BB gun because he wants a gun so badly. He wants to go practice target shooting so badly. He has left the community and come back. And so they give him a BB gun as a sort of like a placeholder of like, well, we'll give you this responsibility. So he takes the BB gun. And when he comes back, in addition to coming back in shiny new clothes and shiny new shoes, he brings back a wad of money and treats for the young brothers specifically.
Yeah, he doesn't give Marcus or Lauren anything. I don't know what Marcus did.
He doesn't get along with, she says that he doesn't get along with Marcus and he's not kind, you know, to Lauren either.
He comes back. So then he starts, when he comes back in the new clothes, that's when the father really, really beats him up, like beats him badly, like in fury and anger. And then the next time he leaves and he takes the gun, he takes his mother's 38, right?
The next time he leaves, he takes his mother's gun. Yes, he does. He takes one of the guns that they have, which is not only a way of protecting themselves when they're out of the community, it's a way of protecting the community at an incredible expense.
And he never speaks to his father again.
Nope. Every time he comes back, he waits until his father is out of the house.
Yeah.
He brings back money and presents for the young kids. The young brothers, yeah. The younger brothers, nothing for Marcus and Lauren. But Lauren is starting to make some plans of her own. So something that we do see, like we see this in Keith. Keith is young. Keith wants to leave this community, which seems idiotic, but we do hear this from other young people. You know, Lauren is wanting to leave this community as well because there's really nothing for them. There are not jobs for them. They cannot afford to go to college. There's nothing for them but staying in this community in a house with their parents. And these teenagers, so Lauren, Lauren's boyfriend, Curtis, Harold, the Garfield family gets an opportunity to leave. We do kind of start to see this is all there is this community. There's nothing here for these kids besides to marry each other and to have more kids that have to be fed and have to be clothed and have to be paid for. And there are not jobs. There is not money to do those things.
There are jobs. There are not jobs. There is a dwindling amount of jobs that pay money because President Donner, who's the president of the United States at the time, along with corporate interests, have conspired to relax labor laws in a way that have brought back the company town. Mm-hmm. So there, when people do have an opportunity or a job, it is in the form of a corporation allowing them to come work and live within this sort of like work-life community where they are paid in either company script, which means it's just stuff that they can only use at a company store. They have to live in company housing, and their wages are often not enough to actually cover living within these communities. So they go into debt, and then they can't stop working there because it is illegal to leave a place of employment if you are in debt to the employer. And these are the kind of opportunities that are cropping. There's more and more of them spreading around more and more of them coming up all around California where they are. And those are the options that they have. There's fewer and fewer Correct. Places that pay, fewer and fewer legal jobs that pay actual cash money.
Which brings me to a little quote that I really enjoyed, because we know, again, that, you know, Octavia Butler is a big science fiction writer. So when we're talking about these types of jobs, there's just a line that I enjoyed where she says, "Cities controlled by big companies are old hat in science fiction." And I just thought that was, I just like that she
drops in a little.
Yeah, it just felt kind of meta to me. So I enjoyed that. I thought that was a fun quote.
The book uses this thing, the company store, the working and living like within the company walls, so to speak. And it is old hat in science fiction. It's also old timey at the same time. That was a common practice for a while where you went out somewhere and you worked a job for the company and you lived in the company housing. And the only store available to you was the company store with the prices set by the company, who knew exactly what everybody was making. And so knew exactly what you could afford right up to the very last dime. But that was a regular thing. Like she's using it as science fiction and even calling it out, like you just said, as science fiction or as something that is old hat in science fiction, but it's totally it's like a historical thing that has actually happened. It is realistic. It is not far-fetched. It's not actually far-fetched at all. It's just a thing that has happened as part of a historical record and not that long ago. The early days of this country.
Correct. I was going to say in like the Industrial Revolution and expanding out to the West. Yes, you're right. This is a big part of like the founding and the growth, I guess, as it were, of our country.
A lot of the things the speculative fiction elements of this are drawn from things that are not far-fetched and that she did not invent. She has just brought them back from the past, actually, and put them 30 years into the future. Like she's reached 100 years behind her and taken these things and put them 30 years in front of her in this
Correct.
Country.
Because slavery is essentially a part of this book too. Like that is also something that is kind of starting to happen.
Because if you get into debt to the company, they've changed the laws so that it is illegal for you to quit as long as you owe the company money. And if the company is paying you not enough money to ever pay them back,
you can't go anywhere.
You can't get at, yeah, which is, it's slavery.
And then there are jobs where there is not pay, it's just room and board.
Yeah.
Which is slavery.
Yeah, yes, yeah, that, yeah.
Right? Yeah. If you're not paying someone, like, you can stay here and live here and we will feed you enough to do the labor that we need you to do, that is slavery. So they
so the pressure cooker in Act One is that everyone is in this community and they are piling up on top of each other. As you pointed out, the houses have multiple families and multiple generations living within them, and there isn't enough room and there isn't enough to go around. And, you know, within this small community, people are getting together and having more kids. They're running out of space. They need somewhere to go. They also would all like to leave. They would like to have, you know, privacy, their own rooms.
Right.
And the options are, you know, corporate township offerings that are, you're unable to research them. They come around in an armored vehicle and pick you up and take you through the wasteland of the regular city streets to whatever community you're going to. It's just a promise someone tells you and says that it'll be a certain way, and you just blindly get in a truck and go. You don't have any way out once you get there. Or like Keith, you go over the wall and just take your chances out there in the world. Or tell me what Lauren's planning.
Okay, so in her conversation with, so she is thinking, you know, so she has Earthseed, or she's starting to get this religion that she is forming, this concept of God being change. She wants to spread it. She understands that it can't grow if it's only inside of her head. It's not going to grow in the community she's in, right? There are belief systems in this community that are already in place. It goes against what her father is teaching, which she doesn't want to do. This is a man that she has respect for. This is a man that also gives her tools that she needs, that we kind of see in some of her conversation, you know, some of her conversations with her father in the book. He is helping to give her tools to also be a leader. So I think that he sees himself in her. She sees some of herself in them, but their ideologies are different. She wants to go out.
And she, you're right. She respects him. She refers to him as the best man she's ever known.
Yeah. So I think she has a lot of respect for him, but their ideologies are different. He believes in a Christian God. And this is not what she is seeing. She can't reconcile this with what she's growing up with, in a society that she's been raised in. So she wants to go out. She wants to spread Earthseed. She wants to teach. And again, like you said, this pressure cooker, she understands that there's not really life within this community. There's not a future, I should say, kind of within this community. And talking to Keith, you know, kind of Keith is telling her, now Keith is going out and doing things that are, I want to use the word illegal, but I guess I could just say he's just going out and doing terrible things. He's robbing people, but he is taken in by a group of miscreants.
He's murdering people.
He's straight up murdering people. He's stealing
from
people.
His second time out, when he brings back that money, he killed a guy.
He kills the guy who's going to Alaska. Or at the very least, he takes everything from him. I guess it's, you know, he doesn't admit that he kills him, but he takes everything from him.
And then he gets defensive when she's like, you murdered a guy. And he's like, I don't know. He could have lived. Not everyone who gets shot dies. But
oh, right. That's, yeah, you're right. He did murder a man. He's taken in by a group of miscreants, basically, who have taken him in because he can read and write. And that gives Lauren this little inkling of like, I can read and write and I can teach people, because she's helping her stepmother run a school in this house as well. So their house is not only a source of the community aspect centered around their house is not only the religious aspect that her father is the preacher for the community for the Sunday services. Almost all of the children in this community are also going to this house 5 days a week to learn, to be taught to read and write by Lauren and Lauren's stepmother.
I also like it in that moment where Keith tells her that, and they have this sort of long conversation. It's the only conversation they really have in the novel, and it's where we learn what Keith has been doing, and it's where we see Lauren pulling information about the outside world, knowing that even if she didn't want to leave, it's going to end. She can see that it isn't going to last, that they're going to be pushed out at some point. But I like that she's irritable about it when he tells her. The only reason the thing that he like offers them is like he can read and write, so he can read all the instructions from all the stolen electronic equipment they've got. They were breaking stuff because they couldn't read the instruction manuals. And she flashes back on like how miserable it had been for her and her stepmother trying to teach him to read when he was younger, like how, what a terrible student, how mean and nasty and resentful he was of them trying to educate him. And now it's the thing he's doing out there.
Right. And now it's what's gotten him that, I mean, and again, we can see that Keith is going to come to a bad end. Nobody is surprised that it happens. His family's not surprised that this is the outcome. But right, he's doing well for himself in the moment. Right. And she, I also kind
According
of enjoyed that,
him,
that it was just like,
he's,
I mean, he keeps coming
also
back with money, right? He keeps coming back with money for the family. And this is something that is not easy to come by.
He returns the gun finally world. Because he gets one of his own. He returns the 38. He also wants to be right. And we can tell from his character, because he keeps telling everyone that, like, he lives real good out there. I live real good out there. He needs that to be true also.
Yes.
Like, regardless of what is actually happening to him or what he's seen or what the world is like out there. Which doesn't sound pleasant.
No, it sounds terrible.
He needs to be correct in leaving, and he needs to present it as being better than what he left behind.
Absolutely.
He's also the thing that he drives the wedge into the family, because the stepmother, his mother, wants the father to go out and look for him, and is like, and the father's like, I wouldn't even begin. He does go out and look for him several times.
They do. They put a lot of effort into trying to find him initially.
But she, the fact that he can't find him, she doesn't really get over. And it also is what, like, she has the outburst where she's like, if it was your precious Lauren, you would look more. And that's when Lauren was sort of like, oh, I thought we loved one another.
Like, oh.
I, she was my stepmother, but we always got along. And like, I loved her. I thought she loved me. And
Corey has been in her, life for most of her life. So this is not somebody that married into the family when Lauren was 12 or 13 and a little older, right? So this is someone who has also helped to raise her. And Lauren, is hurt by that of like, oh, like I know I'm not yours.
You think of the kids as different. Like that's, I am his precious Lauren, and this is these are your kids, and this is your favorite.
Right. Which is a hard thing, because we find out that Keith, not only is Keith killed, Keith is tortured and killed. Keith dies in a horrific manner. His skin is cut and burned off of him in patches, except for his face.
Because and
his eyes have been taken out, I think.
Yeah, there's a very specific drug out there that makes people obsessed with fire. Like they call it several different names, Poe and Pyro and Ro. There's a handful of euphemisms for it throughout the book, but the users become fire obsessed. Like watching fire becomes an incredibly euphoric sensation. Even being in fire becomes somewhat euphoric for them, and they are forever going around setting people and things on fire.
Yes, and enjoying watching that.
Yes.
And so after Keith is killed, and very shortly after this, her dad disappears. Nobody knows what happened to him.
So Keith comes back one more time, and he gives Lauren money that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only time he ever gives her anything. And then and she walks him out to the gate so he doesn't get shot by one of the other guards who don't recognize, you know, because he doesn't live there anymore. And then the next day they get the call that they have to come identify the body. And then she doesn't cry at the funeral, which she sees Corey, the stepmother, seeing her not crying. And that's when she says that it's you know, not that I wasn't sad. It's just that I hated Keith at least as much as I loved him. He was my brother, half brother, but he was also the most sociopathic person I've ever been close to. He would have been a monster if he had been allowed to grow up. Maybe he was one already. He never cared what he did. If he wanted to do something and it wouldn't cost him immediate physical pain, he did it. Fuck the earth. Which is how she describes him. And I think I like that Lauren as a character, as a founder of a religion, as a spiritual person, as someone who is like actively trying to take the ideas of God and heaven that she's been presented from her father and turned them into something that is working and meaningful for her here in this world, is still this honest about things. Like she is not a all is forgiven, everybody was beautiful type person. Like, she's got the internal honesty within herself to recognize that I hated Keith as much as I loved him.
Something I was noticing in this book, in terms of Earthseed. So she kind of says, as she's coming up with Earthseed, this isn't something that is like revealed to her in a burning bush, right? To make like a biblical reference. It's just something that becomes obvious to her that these are truths. And that's how she describes these verses that she's written. She's not making them up. They're not something that have come to her in a flash or through prayer. They just are things that are obvious, and they are statements that are sort of true and obvious. These verses that she writes,
they lack a sort of convoluted mysticism that a lot of, when we read people in books who are prophets or who are founding new religions or who are the leader of some sort of a religion that is invented for the fiction or something like that, they often mirror what is perceived as some of the like more opaque language of faiths, like throughout the world. And, or, you know, they do that. Hers don't.
No, Earthseed is pragmatic.
Is very pragmatic. It is
it's
very,
not,
it's very
not moralistic.
Understandable.
It's not moralistic. No. This is not how you should live your life. It is not about, you know, it is not about kindness as a tool or a path to heaven. It is not about, it is not necessarily about what we should and shouldn't be doing in terms of this like good versus evil, which is a big part of religion. It is pragmatic, and it is a tool to get through this kind of society where there are no right answers and no amount of prayer or this more mystical aspect is going to make, it's not going to make a difference. It is not going to put food on the table. Now, people practice religion for different reasons. There's a lot of talk about what religion is, what religion is to different people, what religion is to different characters in this book. But what she's looking at are tools for dealing with kind of what is there, what this society is, and how to deal with these sort of constant changes that are ongoing. And it is a true thing, right? That the only constant is change.
No, I have to say,
no matter what society you live in,
because so many science fiction books or books that parody faith or that parody preachers have a real sort of gobbledygook sort of thing when they like make up the religion for the fiction. Mm-hmm. Like it's kind of overhyped, or I'm sorry, it's sort of a hyper parodic version of Christianity or something like that. All of the like tenets of Earthseed, totally readable, totally understandable, follow a logic that is a little bit difficult to challenge, and also do not seem meant to provoke. Like the teachings mm-hmm. and the pieces of Earthseed are not there to like jar you out of your comfort zone necessarily, unless you are like, you know, deeply embedded in another faith, whereas any faith that comes along and challenges the one you believe in is meant to be seen as an enemy. But this doesn't even necessarily, it's not even built to disrupt your other faith or move it away from you. Meant to just kind of give you a pragmatic way to move forward. It's interesting that you say that it's not moralistic. And you know, the thing that I noticed is that it doesn't need to be. And it doesn't need to be because she doesn't need to be moralistic, because she has a biological conscience, because she has hyper-empathy. No one has to tell her not to hurt other people. She's never in her entire life needed to know not to cause harm, because she can't, because it physically hurts her to cause harm.
Interesting. Oh, I like that. Yeah, that's a really good point.
She calls it out when I say, so she mentions it at one point. She says she thought it'd be interesting if like Keith had what she had, that it might make him a better person or something like that. And then she was kind of wavering on whether or not it was nice to like wish something like that on somebody. But she makes the comment that a biological conscience is better than no conscience at all. But if you've got a built-in biological conscience, the religion that you're building probably doesn't need to have a lot of do not kill, do not maim, do not harm built into it, because it wouldn't occur to do that in the first place.
True. And this is also a, I mean, this is also a society, you know, something that we see particularly once she is outside of the community. If we're kind of going through the if we're kind of going through this book by, you know, by the plot, you know, shortly after Keith dies, her father disappears, and something that Lauren has had her finger on from the beginning of this book, this wall around the community. When I read this book, when I was initially reading this book, I picture this as like a 30-foot high wall. I picture this as like a real fortress around this community. It's a 10-foot wall. It's 3 meters. That is 9 feet and 10 inches. Yes, I had to Google that because I don't understand the metric system. It is 9 feet and 10 inches.
No,
That's not a lot of protection.
it's like a wall you put around a junkyard to protect junk.
Yeah, like
Like it's
it's
a
you can use a ladder and climb over it, which is how some thieves are getting in, which is how some of the violence that does infiltrate the community is getting in. So Lauren understands that one day people are just going to pour over this wall and take everything from this community. So it's not even only about the fact that this community is that there's not a future in this community, that there's not anywhere to go for these younger people. It's that one day she understands this community is not going to be there, and then that happens. And she's prepared for it. And she is one of the only people in this community that is prepared. She has a go bag. She has a go bag that she gets, and she runs out of there. She loses track of her family almost immediately. Almost everyone in the community is killed. There are some people that we don't know what happens to them because there's not a plan for the day that this happens.
And
So
she
when
brought
she,
it up to her father before that she thought he should be, as a leader of the community, getting people prepared for this. And he told her no. He wasn't like furious or anything, but he told her not to talk about it. He told her not to bring it up. And she was like, why? And his reasoning was, it is better to teach people than to scare them, Lauren. If you scare them and nothing happens, they lose their fear and you lose some of your authority with them, which is thoughtful. He turns out to be wrong, but
he
he's
turns
not
out to
wrong.
be
This,
wrong because when
he's
this
not wrong because he was
community.
arrogant or hubristic or because he was a schmuck or anything like that.
Well,
He was just wrong. And he meant
something.
well.
Well, I want to finish a thought, and then I want to come back to that conversation, or to that idea of his hubris. Out in the so when she's out of the community and she's out on the road with, you
So
know, with
let's
Harold and
just a,
Zara.
it happens in a flash. The like people come over the wall, they start setting things on fire. It's madness immediately, and like the community's gone in a night.
The community's gone
Burned
in the
down,
night.
murdered, kidnapped, raped and killed. Like just people are just poof, it's over.
She's very lucky to sort of find Harold and Zara outside of the community. Harold and Zara have found each other. Harold saves Zara essentially. She is her child has been taken from her. Her husband and the families that she lives with are all killed. Her child is taken from her, murdered, thrown into a fire. She's being raped. Harold pulls the guy off of her, and they manage to escape. They manage to find Lauren. So back to this kind of idea of like, why doesn't this need to be moralistic, this religion? So they're out on the road. They're not trying to kill people. So they're not out trying to steal from people. They're not out just trying to murder people for the sake of murdering. They're not out murdering people so they can eat them. But they have to kill some people to protect themselves.
It makes me annoyed at Harold the first time she has to kill someone when those two guys attack them.
Oh
And
yeah, and
then
he's
Harold,
kind of a weenie about it, and it's like,
oh my God, he's just sort of like, he's like, oh, so this is a thing we do now? And like, dude,
yeah, man,
you
this
were
is a thing
there.
that we're
Like
gonna
you
do because this guy would have
yeah.
murdered us and raped your girlfriend.
Like they were in the it's not like we suspected they might. They were in the act of doing it, and we got, we happened to win this round.
They were legitimately attacking us. Yeah.
Yeah.
These.
It's an action scene, Harold.
So
It happened.
it's not like we just wanted to murder these people because we didn't like the looks of them. They would have murdered us.
It put me
You
off
know.
on Harold for I Harold is perfectly fine throughout the rest of the book, but like I kept going back and rereading it and I was like, I missed something. And like, no, he's just it's like he wasn't there for the parts of the book that I
Right.
read
At the
that
same
he's in.
time, Lauren Lauren has a pretty incredible intelligence. Lauren is raised by two people that are very educated. They have given her a very good education. But Lauren is just somebody who, Lauren is just somebody of great intelligence and great empathy. Again, like the hyper empathy is probably something that gives her a lot of feedback and a lot of understanding of the world that some of these other people aren't going to have. Harold feels very sheltered to me. And I think Harold is a little bit shocked. And I mean, I do think his response is a little bit hilariously like, Harold, what did you think the other outcome was going to be? Did you think the police were going to come in and save you? Because that's not a thing in this world. It's not a thing on the road. That has never been a thing in your lifetime. The police aren't trusted. You have to pay them to come and do things for you. And they don't really do anything. They're extortionists.
I have two of the things that I find, I don't know, distracting about it, or things that I would change, whatever. My two complaints with the book. One is Harold's a bizarre inconsistency, because even if he was a little sheltered, it wasn't like he lived on one of the like rich people's houses up on the hill. He lived in the same community. Like, he's very aware of the world and how it goes. And just, you know, he was there when everything got burned down. Like, these people aren't coming from a world of plenty and like suddenly they're on the road, you know, with the heathens. They've lived right, you know, cheek to cheek with this their whole lives. It seems like bad characterization for the purposes of the book and the narrative. He needs to suddenly like not understand what world he lives in for, I don't know, 40 pages of act two. Whatever. The other one is actually the police. The fact that like they keep going to the police for things. Like, from the opening like 15 pages of the book, we are told the police, the fire department, like city services, state services aren't a thing. Like, they just rob you. They don't solve things. If you call them, they just take your money and there's nothing you can do about it. If you go to them, they take your money and there's nothing you can do about it. And sometimes they'll keep you on some trumped up charge and sell you to one of these corporations as a worker. Like, there's right. Everyone in the book seems to recognize, and yet they keep being like, oh, we should go talk to the police. Like, what? Stop doing that.
So that brings me to something this is the first note I made in this book. She talks about, so the quote unquote adults in this book really romanticize the past. And they're kind of blotting out.
Everyone who does it is one of the older people who recognizes the world as it was before we enter it as the reader. That's true.
And they, for some reason, think they're going to get back to it. So like this is a quote. This is page 8. This is early on. They never miss a chance to relive the good old days or to tell kids how great it's going to be when the country gets back on its feet and good times come back. This strikes me for a lot of reasons. For one, this is anarchy, this society. What do you think we're getting back to? And how do you think that we're getting back to this in your lifetime or even in your children's lifetime? But I also think that is a strength in this book and the author, because that is what boomers do now.
No, it's a very common thing for everyone. Everyone looks to their past.
Everybody
and it's like, man, the good
back.
Old days. Like, everyone thinks, if you go on Facebook tonight, someone in there is talking about how, like, when I grew up, we played outside. And, like, they're talking about like 2002. It's a very
100%. Like, I was gonna say, as a cusper millennial and a Gen X, my husband and I were talking about this the other night. Of like, I feel like we got lucky with technology. We didn't grow up with phones in our hands. We didn't grow up with social media. We played outside. I played softball and it was on Tuesdays and Thursdays. My Saturdays were free to go like play and do fun kid things that weren't organized by adults. This is such, exactly. Everybody looks
everyone,
back at
every,
what they
every,
had.
Everyone believes it of the past that it was better.
And
no, you're right.
And that is a huge thing now, I think, politically now, because our country has a lot of divide in it, right? And I'm not going one way or the other on this, but I'm saying that there is a lot of looking back at like, oh, you know, we look back at like the 50s and the nuclear families. We have like trad wives and these young women that are like, oh, like things were better back then. And it's like, girl, domestic violence was off the charts. We had segregation. Like things were horrible then, also.
Also, I do, yeah, I will say
Also,
things
there
could
was some good
also,
stuff then, just like there's some good stuff now.
things just also had the potential to also be terrible, like all times.
Like all
She's
times.
got when Lauren is talking to her friend Joanna, who doesn't like Lauren's collapse of community talk, but
No, it frightens me.
she refers to the current president as a human banister. And Joanna's like, what? And she's like, a banister, like on the stairs. And she says, he's like a symbol of the past for us to hold on to as we're pushed into the future. He's nothing, no substance. But having him there, you know, the latest in a 2.5 century long line of American presidents, make people feel that the country, the culture that they grew up in is still the country, the culture that they grew up with is still here, that we will get through these bad times and back to normal. And so I guess maybe my complaint about them constantly going back to the police, even though every time they go to the cops, it's just, I picture in like a video game when you spend money on something and it's like it makes a little cushing cash register sound and
Yeah.
like the dollars go down in the corner. Like you like every visit to the police is just like cushing, and then like they lose $2,000. That's it.
Right.
And all the way up to the end of the book, the bankroll, who's a great character, but he's a lot older than her. He's her father's age, I think, probably.
I think so. I think he's your father's age, more or less. Yeah.
Yeah, insists on going to the police. And he actually several times comments on like, just like, if you, I wish you would knew what the world was like. I wish you understood. Like, because I think from his point of view, they don't even know what to go back to. Like these, the younger people don't understand what they're even missing completely. They know it sucks, but they don't understand
They don't understand
how
what it was
good
like
it,
before and
yeah.
how and that it was just a generation ago that things were better. But you know, something when we look back at the past, we look back at the past, it was better, it was better. That past has created this present. That's true in this book. That is true of the boomers' time and now. That is true of, you know, us growing up in the 90s, getting to play outside. But anything that was going on socially and politically then has put us where we are now. Anything that was going on socially and politically in the 50s and 60s has put us where we are now. You know, what was going on in the 70s and 80s when these adults in this world were younger is what has created this absolute chaos of a society, this absolute breakdown of social justice and economic justice and the climate,
I
totally,
think that's
right?
where, yeah, no, and I think that's,
So
I
we can
think
go back
what
and
you just
romanticize
described.
this, but that is what but what was going on then is the reason we have these disparities now.
I think what you just described is where the title comes from. And I think that title, I think it's really neat. The title is doing like five things in the book. Like it's, I know a lot of times titles are just given to a book to like set, like to either, you know, what sells, or we have to call it something. Like I know titles do not necessarily always carry portent and meaning, but this one is reflective of what you just said. Like the world that the characters live in at the very basic level is the parable of the sower. And for people who might not know, the parable of the sower comes from the Christian Bible. And I will be really abbreviated with it, but the parable describes the farmer, I'll say, throwing his seeds down, sowing his seeds into his furrows, and some of the seeds spill out to the sides outside of the furrows. Some spill on rocky ground, and the seeds bloom briefly, but they don't get nourished and they die. Some fall on fallow ground and never sprout at all. Some grow up among thorns and grow, but get choked out. And it's a parable about the way the, in the book, the word of Christ will impact different people who hear it. The seeds that fall outside of the furrow, though, and land on fertile ground, grow and bloom and reproduce 100 times over. So the title is doing the work to describe just the situation itself, like the world that these children, our main character, is inheriting is what was sown before her. And here it is, what you just went through. It also, though, describes her relationship with her father and the fact that he was a man of faith, was a man of God, was a man of the cloth. He was an actively, like, a practicing Baptist minister, and passed that along to his daughter, who is not taking precisely what he gave her, but is, he sowed the seeds and she's growing it into something else. Another faith, another way of thinking of God, another way of thinking of the world. Also just the cycle of the book where we start with one community and we end with another. And the seeds that were sown into these children, into Harold, Zahara, Lauren, carry through to the community where they end up in the end.
Yes. You're right. This title does have a lot. Just, yeah.
It's a title that actively has meaning and several meanings throughout the work.
But when we were talking about, Lauren's conversation with her father, where he's kind of warning her against, talking to people about the destruction of their walled community. And you were saying, it's a little bit of this hubris. I don't disagree with you, but I think
to be clear, what I was saying was he's wrong, but I like that he's not wrong out of hubris. He doesn't think his daughter is dumb and you don't know what you're talking about. He doesn't think that it's not an arrogance that leads him to be mistaken, or at least not like a malicious arrogance or anything like that. He's just wrong because he just reads it wrong. He just reads the situation around him incorrectly. He thinks, I guess a little bit of hubris, he thinks he can bring it back. He thinks he can teach people and get them there without actively talking about the reality around them. But
I see.
He doesn't dismiss his daughter's ideas as dangerous or stupid or she's just mistaken. He thinks that she's right. He just doesn't think that the way she wants to go around and tell everybody they need to start making go bags is going to be productive for what he's trying to hold on to and the community he's trying to keep, hopeful.
Right. And I think he's holding on to some of this past.
But I suppose you're right. I suppose there is a hubris to that.
There is a little bit of a hubris to that.
It's not a malicious hubris, though.
But I think it comes from this. I think some of it comes from this, from romanticizing the past, from thinking that there is a way back. There is no way back from where they are now. There is, and Lauren sees that. There is a way through it, and that's the basis for Earthseed. There is a way through this. We are not going back. For her, to your point, she has no idea what they're going back to. She doesn't know what the world was like before when there was water. You know what I mean?
She has a go bag full of seeds, some other materials, some books, some things that she's packed together.
Some
money that she has saved, and an idea
to go north where there is apparently more jobs and the climate is not quite is there's a little more water. Apparently the climate
read in my research and sort of the way this book is described is always says in a world where climate change is a huge thing. I know that the scarcity of water is an issue for them. I had a very hard time trying to decipher if climate change is a term we're using now to apply to this book because we think about it, because the book is set in California. And as far as I know from the history of California, from when it was founded up until 5 minutes ago, is sort of fraught environmentally in an independent way from whatever other environmental problems are happening around the world. Like LA shouldn't be there. There was never enough water for LA.
There are environmental problems in other parts of the country that are mentioned. There are superstorms. There are diseases. Water is short everywhere. Water is in short supply.
I had a hard time telling what might be climate change and what might be just this is California. If you turn on the news, not even just now, but if you were to look at since California's existed, there's a drought and a wildfire is, I don't know, like a every 2 year thing. Just like, oh,
correct.
Oh, this is the year that California burns and runs out of water.
No, climate change is a part of this. Other parts of the country are seeing super storms, incredible weather. There is a shortage of water in other parts of the country. Okay. There are diseases that are spreading unchecked. Measles is back in like the in our part of, or well, in my part of the country in the Northeast. Measles are back and killing people is mentioned in the book.
Wait, in the book, measles are also back?
In this book, measles are also back. Okay, so that makes me segue
I'm not comfortable with the parallels to actual 2024 that are in this book set in the future 2024.
Okay, and it is unavoidable, and I want to talk about them. The first thing I want to talk about is what is referred to in the book as the street poor. So it is what we see outside of the walls of the walled community. And it is some of what we see on the road. A lot of what we're seeing, I feel like, on the road is other people that are displaced. But the street poor and the desperate are there also kind of creating chaos and wreaking havoc. How different the extremism is different. But here's what I want to ask. How different is the violence and the desperation of the street poor that we are seeing in outside of the walled community and on the road, different from the level of violence as we see in low income areas and now and today, where there is an increase in violence and where that increase is driven by social disparities? And it is driven by the fact that a lot of these people do not have basic needs that are being met. We have poverty and hunger in our country that we think of as happening in developing nations. And those things happen here. Those things happen where those are things that are happening in low-income areas where you live. And those are things that are happening in low-income areas where I live. And there is increased violence. And there's statistics on this, or increased violence in these areas. And we can look at that and see that it is directly because basic needs are not being met. And how is that different from what we're seeing in this? Now, again, the horrificness, the extremism is a difference. So that aside, do we
there was a man missing his head.
There was a man missing his head and a woman walking around naked and dazed. But I mean, there's a rampant drug problem that is causing havoc. That is causing havoc for a lot of people.
No, it's the, sort of why I was asking, like, if we would call this dystopian, because a lot of the things that are in it are not future problems, or they're not an author's reinvention of something that is a metaphor or a parallel to something in our own lives, but is different within the science fiction world of the novel. It's some things she's just reached into the past and pulled them into the future, like the company store and concepts like that. And others are just heightened versions of things that are happening in the town you live in today.
Right. And when we think about, you know, if you're looking at this walled community that Lauren's grown up in, this is middle class, right? Look at how much more they have than the people that are outside, that are immediately outside of their wall.
The people she mentions, the like resentment the people outside of the walls have for them in that walled cul-de-sac there. And it's interesting because it's relative wealth. Mm-hmm. Like it's the people within that cul-de-sac are poor and struggling and doing their best. They're not wealthy people, but by comparison, like it's a relative wealth compared to someone who lives on a box on the street outside and might be killed at any moment arbitrarily for anything they have on them by the sort of amoral wandering hordes that are out there, or by someone who's just on a drug that makes them think it's really neat to set people on fire.
Right.
For the pleasure in it.
So, and again, there's something that's indicated in this book, there's not a lot of middle class.
There's also not a lot of hope. Like that's kind of the thing that she comes back to is that these people don't have, they've taken away any way for them to improve their lives.
Yeah.
Like there is a dwindling, nearly extinguished little kernel of jobs that still pay actual money that aren't, you only work if you enter into this Baroque Baroque contract with us about where you live, where you're allowed to shop, how much food you get, and you know, all of it is kind of controlled here, and you waive your rights to complain about it. Mm-hmm. Which means that there's no way to ever improve your life. And she has a tells us, like, people are setting fires because they're frustrated, angry, hopeless. They have no power to improve their lives, but they have the power to make others even more miserable. And the only way to prove to yourself that you have power is to use it. So people are going around just taking their lives out on one another.
Absolutely. So again, like, so we see the
community, after the community burns down, she gets Zahara, she gets Harold, they hit the road and they're walking north. And they encounter the first conflict. Harold's a real weenie about it, or I think it's just a flaw in the book personally, but whatever, he gets over it a couple of pages later.
It
just seems to be there because there needs to be a conflict in those 40 pages.
Now remember that this is not a shocking situation for Zahra. Zahra grew up on the streets. Zahra's mother sells her to Richard Moss. She is his third wife because he's just decided that he can have multiple wives and families. She's sold to him by her mother, who was a drug addict as a teenager. And now the Olaminas don't have a great impression of this guy, Richard Moss, partly because he's a polygamist, among some other things. But Zahra's like, yeah, this guy didn't hit me. And he gave me a place to live. It was the first time I ever lived in a house. And I eat. And like, I had a job. I mean, you know, they had their jobs. They raised like rabbits and stuff and made some money. So it's just like, she's, you know, she doesn't have anything bad to say about this guy. And now she's just back out on the streets. So like, this situation of being attacked is not new to her. Lauren's just had her finger, I think, a little bit more on like, this is what this is going to be. One day I'm going to be outside of these walls, and this is what happens outside of these walls. And Harold's had his head in the sand a little bit. So this could, I mean, Harold.
Apparently, yeah.
I guess I'm making an excuse for Harold. This is a pretty shocking thing to have happened. And
Where Zahra talks about Richard Moss.
Just on Harold real quick. I think some of what shocks Harold so much is that Lauren is capable of this. If your childhood friend just straight out murdered somebody in front of you, kind of regardless of what the situation was, that is kind of a minute of like, well, that's different from when we used to, you know, play together outside. Like, that's a shocking thing. It's a shocking thing to see. And Harold has also just lost all of his family and his community is in his life. He has one thing that he knows well, that he knows pretty well. It's Lauren, and now she's just murdered somebody. In self-defense, of course.
He's also a weenie when, like, he finds out that she's a hyper empath, where he's like, I don't know if I can ever trust you again. And like, shut up, Harry.
She saved your life twice.
You've known her since you were kids.
This is like a fairly large weakness to like share with people. This is not a thing you want people to know about you and have this power to use it against you and legitimately incapacitate you.
Maybe it's not a narrative fault. Maybe it's just I don't like Harold as a character because he's about as deep as a frisbee. And maybe I shouldn't call it a narrative.
Harold, I don't think it's Octavia Butler's fault. I think it's Harold's fault, but Harold comes around. Harold initially is a bit of the weak link in the three. The kind of the one thing Harold brings to the table a little bit is that he is male. Right? Like, it's like, okay, Lauren is posing as a man to be on the road. And it looks safer for them to have two men and a female. And that certainly seems safer than three females together, you know, on the road. So that's kind of the edge he brings in the beginning. But Zahra gives them a little bit of this edge because Zahra has done this. But I find
it frustrating in any media when there's a character who has seen all the same things that I have seen as the audience member or the reader. You've been present for all the same things I've been present for. What's your problem? What do you mean? How could she have killed that guy who was trying to murder her? What kind of a dumbass question is that to be asking? What's the matter with you?
He comes around, though. He comes around. He ends up being a bit of a he comes around to understand Earthseed more, and he becomes a little bit of a proponent of Earthseed when Lauren is trying to explain this to the sort of various other travelers that they end up linking up with.
So they're walking north. They kill these two guys. I do like that whenever like they have these incidents, they just collect a little bit more supplies. We found some money in this guy's shoe, and we found a pocket full of bullets, and we found one knife and three pieces of string and a tarp. Like they're just collecting little materials as they go, but they also start collecting people.
They start to collect people. They start with Travis and Natividad, who are
a
little boy. Dominic is there. They have a baby, Dominic. And they were slaves, straight up slaves, right? So they lived on a rich person's compound for room and board, basically. And their story is that the wife, the female of the couple that they work for, seems to be like she kind of a kinder person. But unfortunately, the man of the house takes an interest in Natividad after she and Travis are married. And it's apparent that he's going to, you know, he'll rape her or try to conquest her. The wife doesn't love this. And instead of taking it out on these two people, which she could do, that's a pretty traditional slave narrative. She helps them to leave. She helps them to escape. She gives them a little money and she gets them out. They seem okay. So she's noticed them a little bit, you know, partly because they have a baby. Some thieves come and try to steal the water from Natividad that she's like just filled up and paid for. And they kind of help out. Like when one of the thieves tries to run away, Lauren trips him.
Yeah. But I mean, Natividad and Travis don't try to steal from them. And then they catch, there's not like a,
oh, sure. No, they just
see them. And for a couple of days, they're kind of walking together and they're like, those people seem cool. And then they help them out and they are cool and it works out.
Yeah.
Like that's the,
they just, help
oh,
them out.
People
they help
in the
them
world
when,
are just nice.
When they're camping, the dogs come onto the beach. They try to take the baby. Dogs in this book are wild.
Yeah.
You know, as a cat person, I'd like to point out that Lauren points out that like cats are kind of cool and she enjoys watching them because they just run around and eat rats and leave everybody alone. And meanwhile, the dogs all go feral. Just saying. I mean, I love
I don't
dogs.
Think, I mean, in
I
the
like
U.S.
dogs as the next person, but the dogs in this book are wild.
We happen to live in a country where like dogs are mostly domesticated and like just like creatures that just live amongst us. But if you go to other parts of the world where that's not the case, like feral dogs are a problem. Like just on the streets of, certain cities and stuff, like they're an issue. Like,
no, yeah, there's like packs of dogs running around and stuff.
So, dogs have to be domesticated. They are not co-domesticates like cats are, where cats are just sort of like, I choose to be amongst people. Like dogs are not our friends until we make them understand that they have to be our friends.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. But dogs come and try to take poor little baby Dominic and she shoots one of the dogs and the dogs run away. And then Natividad and Travis, they've been invited, like if you want to kind of hang out with us, and they're rightfully suspicious because you can't trust anybody out and, you know, on the road, but they end up kind of coming around. And I like the Travis seems like the one who gives her like some pretty big pushback on Earthseed. And they do have a conversation that I think is really interesting, where they're talking about Earthseed. And Lauren says, show me a more pervasive power than change. And Travis says, no one's going to worship that. And I found that to be interesting because we get a lot of, throughout the book, we get a lot of things about what religion means to different people. You know, we talked about, you know, this is not a moralistic religion. It's very pragmatic. You know, you're not praying for change. And I'm not saying that prayer doesn't have a beautiful place. And I'm not saying that prayer doesn't have comfort or doesn't offer things to people, right? Prayer can be a really powerful thing. But these different, all of these different concepts that go into, I think, like what makes something a religion? Is it that it's moralistic and it tells us how to live? Is it that we're praying to something and we're surrendering to a higher power, and that we don't have power, that we're giving up our power over something a little bit, and putting it towards faith. And then his concept of, well, no one's going to worship that. So it's like, is that what religion has to be, is worshiping something? Is that what God has to be for everybody, is worship? Because what Lauren is offering is a way to shape God and to work with God. And where does that, you know, where does that fit into different religions? I just thought that was an interesting conversation. Does God have to be something that is worshiped, or something that is yielded to? And, you know, Lauren again is offering something different.
Well, her God is change, and her God is indifferent to her. Change itself is also not moralistic. Change is just change. She tells us several times within here, both when she's talking to people and within the sort of like the text of Earthseed's Book of the Living that is sown, pun totally intended, throughout this book. The power of change is something that you are doing, whether you choose to wield it consciously and thoughtfully or not, you still do it. If you're Keith, you do it. It's thoughtless. It's selfish. His actions are done with no thought to anybody else, but change is still wrought. The family dynamic is split. Her relationship with Corey is forever altered. Corey and the father's relationship is forever altered because of him. Whereas our parallel is Lauren, who very thoughtfully takes this power and tries to cultivate it and tries to shape it and tries to give it some meaning. And you know, by the end of the book, she's shepherded, what do we got, like 20 human lives left, between 15
around,
and 20,
I think if you're counting the kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, living in a sort of maybe safe plot of land with the future ahead of them.
And so something I really love that I think is an overture in this book is this sense of community. So, you know, as they're gathering people, you know, they gather. Travis, Natividad, and Dominic. So they see Bankole on the road. Bankole likes the look of them. She definitely likes the look of Bankole. And they hear some women crying in distress. And they say a house has collapsed in an earthquake. They save these two girls from the rubble of this house, Allie and Jill. Allie and Jill kind of pick up Earthseed from Lauren. They pick up that they've come into this. You know, Allie's like, you know, what is this, a cult? She feels very like against the religious aspect of this, but these people have just saved her. And she recognizes that having a community and a group of people is going to be a safer way for her to travel with their sister.
And also fair. I mean, you're in a world where people are just wandering around all the time on the street. You happen to fall in with the ones who are like, can I tell you about Earthseed? Like, I can just see you being like, I mean, I get Allie being like, oh man.
Oh, 100%. I totally feel Allie.
It's like you get the knock at the door and you're like, my Amazon package. And someone's like, could I tell you a little bit about the Church of Latter-day Saints? Could I tell you about being a Mormon? You're like, oh, you're not the socks I ordered.
Right. So I get where Allie's coming from. And then a few other people, you know, as they're continuing to gather people, they gather Emery and Tori. They gather a few other people along the way. And, you know, Earthseed is introduced. And a lot of these people stay with the group because they need a group, because they like the idea of protection, because they like the idea of community. And I think that is such a huge draw for people when it comes to organized religion, is a sense of community, as much as they're getting anything else from it, as much as prayer is a comfort, as much as parables or verses or whatever the tome of choice is, right, that kind of informs your religion. There's comfort in that. You can look at that for life advice, for advice with problems that you're having. Maybe you do want a God to worship. Maybe you do want a God to put your faith in or to surrender to. But at the heart of all of these things is community. And I think at the heart of something that is a basic human need, that we know is a basic human need, is a sense of society and a sense of community, and the comfort and the peace that comes with that, regardless of sort of what what the religion is, or maybe what the ideologies are. I think that's something that Lauren and her dad share. So like I talked about, you know, he's kind of helping in that conversation that we talked about with them, or he's helping to give her some tools for like, this is how you teach people. This is how you guide people. And we see that she uses some of that, and she uses some of the leadership that she sees in him to help start to form this community. But I think he's the one that teaches her the importance of that, because something that she does say to all of these people is it's like, you don't have to conform to what I'm teaching. I'm going to tell you about it. I'd like to teach you about it. And you can listen if you like, but we're not stealing from each other and we are helping each other out. Are you willing to do that? And if you are, you can travel with us. So it's not this, it's not forcing some ideology on somebody. It is offering this sense of community. And then with that, she is also offering these verses because she finds comfort in them. And she is offering these ideas because she finds comfort in them. And she sees that a community living by these truths, as she calls them, can be a strong community within this particular time and this particular sort of chaotic existence.
The hyperempathy doesn't really play a part in the book.
It doesn't hugely, and I'm trying to remember if it comes back a little more in the second book. I think the hyperempathy is partly to give Lauren a little bit of a weakness. She needs one as a character.
They get into battles a couple of times.
Because she's a really strong character, and so I think that she needs a little chink in her armor, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean,
from a narrative standpoint, right? There needs to be something that holds her back a little bit, and that's part of it.
It just feels like if you're going to introduce Chekhov's hyperempathy at the beginning of your book, at some point, maybe it puts the group in danger, or it puts our heroine's life in danger, or she has to make a choice that's based on it. But nope, we just don't do that.
Like, well, remember, there's a second book, and there was meant to be a third.
Sure, but this is also a complete book in and of itself.
Like, it's true.
It does strike me as odd that, because there's a couple times in like high tension scenes where she gets like taken out of commission and like she falls down, and then, you know, she's the one narrating this for us. She comes back around and like things have just happened. But in no way does her like being taken out of the game really impact anything. Like, Jill's death is not because she was taken out. It's not like she could have prevented it.
Right.
But you know, the hyperempathy is the thing that cost her, and she has to like deal with that and think about it. And it puts something on her and Allie's relationship. No, it doesn't impact her relationship with Bankel, whose name I'm almost positive we're not saying correctly. Right. Like, that's not,
there's a very good chance that we are not saying his name correctly.
No, yeah. No way we're getting that right. The main character, Lauren Olamina, seemed like an older person's ideal of a younger person. And I think that is something that informs the comment you made that she gave her the hyperempathy just so she would have some sort of flaw.
All right. Do we have any other points or anything to make, or should we do quotes?
No, we can do quotes. I don't have any other points.
So this is just, again, because there's a lot of discussion about religion and what religion is to different people. And I mean, and something that I just think is powerful about that in this book is that religion is different things to so many different people. We have so many religions around the world. People believe so many different things that I just think that that's such a valid part of this book and such a valid thing to explore. And so Lauren speaks to that a little bit in the beginning. This is on page 15. And she says, a lot of people seem to believe in a big daddy god, or a big cop god, or a big king god. They believe in a kind of super person. A few believe God is another word for nature, and nature turns out to mean just about anything they happen to not understand or feel in control of. Some say God is a spirit, a force, an ultimate reality. Ask seven people what all of that means, and you'll get seven different answers. So what is God? Just another name for whatever makes you feel special and protected. And I just think those are interesting questions to pose. So whatever your feelings about God or beliefs about god or gods or whatever it is are, I think it's interesting. And I think I've always been interested in what God and religion mean to other people. I'm always very interested in other religions and what they believe and what their ideologies are, because I just think that it's interesting. I feel like it's interesting to see people put a name or a face or an idea or a thought to that which can't be explained, which I think is something that's at the root of so much religion, right? Is that we're trying to explain what we can't explain, why we're here, why we die, and who put us here and what we're supposed to do while we're here.
I think the first quote that I have is probably a nice follow on to that. In the context, she's kind of talking about how the destiny of Earthseed is to take root amongst the stars, and how that happens and when it happens and all the things that must go into it. She's not quite sure of yet. But I think this also works for whichever one of those kinds of gods or religions or things that you believe in. She says, there's always a lot to do before you get to go to heaven.
I liked that too.
Which I like for literally any situation of just, I have to work all day before I can come home and have pizza. I have to do all this stuff before, I don't know, you can go on vacation. Like, just, it works both as a thought around faith and sort of the way we structure faith and the reward system based on it, based on whichever one of those sort of gods or structures or nature-based religions that you believe in. But no matter which one it is, there's always a lot to do before you get to go to heaven. I like that.
I have a short quote that I just thought, this is not a funny book. This is probably there's a possibility that this is the least funny book we've done so far.
This might be the least funny.
This is the least funny book that we've done so far. I mean, Slaughterhouse-Five has got stuff in it that's funny.
No, Slaughterhouse-Five has some parts that are laugh out loud funny.
The Outsiders yeah. had a couple funny lines. This is definitely the least funny book we've done. But I just think this is cute. And she's just talking about, like, this is like about life on, life in the walled community and what people are doing in the very small amount of time that they're not trying to just like provide for themselves to get their basic needs met. She's talking about how they like to play out in the street. People used to play baseball, but we just can't afford what that costs in windows. And I don't know. I just thought that was funny. And there's just nothing in this book that is humorous. So that, I think, maybe stood out to me, because she's like, oh, we use part of the paved street for like volleyball, touch football, basketball, or tennis. People used to play baseball, but we just can't afford what that costs in windows.
I have one. She's talking, someone sort of suggests, the things she's kind of put together for Earthseed, like whatever is making a comment on them. And she replies by saying that stumbling across the truth isn't the same as making things up as a defense. She's like, I didn't invent this. I didn't make it up. This is true, which we've talked about. It is. It's a very logic-based, pragmatic set of beliefs. Like, the tenets of it are not otherworldly. They're not super opaque. They're not mysteries to be unraveled. It's
not something. It's not something that's been revealed to her, by an angel or some other ethereal being. And so the last quote that I have to read is also a verse from Earthseed, the Books of the Living, that I just think is really beautiful, and I think is sort of a sum up of a summary, as it were, of the root of a lot of religion. It says, create no images of God except the images that God has provided. They are everywhere in everything. God is change. Seed to tree, tree to forest, rain to river, river to sea, grubs to bees, bees to swarm. From one, many, from many, one. Forever uniting, growing, dissolving, forever changing. The universe is God's self-portrait. I just think that's really beautiful, particularly the last line, the universe is God's self-portrait. And I see this as being something that's applicable in a lot of different religions. I don't, I think this is something that a lot of religions could kind of like see and pull things from and feel that this is, what we see God. We see God in ourselves, and we see God in the things that are around us. And I feel like that's, perhaps not universal for religion, but I feel it's a fairly universal concept that fits in with a lot of people's ideologies. And that's my favorite of the Earthseed verses.
So would you recommend this one?
I mean, I would.
I'm asking that mostly out of a formality because you recommended it to me and that's how we got here. But
so yes, I would absolutely recommend it. And I, for our listeners, I did, I read these books fairly recently. By recently, I mean, in the year of we're in early 2024. So in 2023, I read these books, and then did immediately text Kennedy to be like, I'm going to bring you some books or I'm going to mail these books to you because I want to, it was before we decided to do this podcast, but it was like, I've read them and now I need to discuss them with somebody.
I'm looking forward to Parable of the Talents. All right. So as always, you can write to us with nice thoughts and ideas and compliments at readingpopclassics@gmail.com. And for our next book, we are not intentionally, but I guess we are going back to Reese's Book Club, actually, with a popular novel from, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng. So that's what we'll be reading next time here on Reading Pop Classics. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for listening.